Life is a series of circles and cycles, phrases and stages. These are your experiences that teach you the lessons of life. You can either ignore them or embrace them. Welcome to the James Cooley Show.
We're talking about diversity, equity, and inclusion. So, Michelle, can you tell our listening audience what today's purpose of the show is?
Yes, today's purpose of the show is getting to know diversity, equity, and inclusion advocate Dr. Melissa Horn. Discover why her education focused on Black history. Learn why she has become an DEI advocate. Learn about the company, Dialectic, and to learn about her podcast, Just One Q.
Can you please introduce this great guest to our audience?
Yes. Dr. Melissa Horn, relatable and inspiring diversity, equity, and inclusion advocate, is passionate about combining science and activism to drive change within organizations. The director of client experience at Dialectic, she is an innovator working at the convergence of science, smart design, and technology to change behavior and transform company culture. As the host of Just One Q, a podcast focused on DEI in the workplace, she and her guests offer specific action items to drive listeners from awareness to action. Dr. Horn is well-versed in the history of race and social justice and has worked in both Canada and the United States on employment equity and LGBTQTS+ rights. Engaging and authentic, she not only offers audiences new perspectives, but outlines concrete ways to take part in creating workplaces built for the new age. Her deep expertise in critical thinking, decision-making, and problem-solving is grounded by a PhD in Black history from Rutgers University. The James Cooley Show, It's Your Life, proudly presents Dr. Melissa Horn.
How you doing, Doctor? Dr. Horn, welcome
wow.
to the show. Welcome to the show.
When you read that, it sounds really exciting. Thank you.
Dr. Horn, it is exciting because you are exciting. Yeah, so, hey, first of all, I want to thank you for taking the time to come on the show. And I know that our listening audience is like, okay, JC, let's get to it. Dr. Horn, can you tell our listening audience where you're from and your background? I know that you're a Canadian, but you went to school in the United States. Can you tell our listening audience a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I'm from it's not a huge city, but it's about a mid-sized city in called Guelph. We're about an hour outside of Toronto. We have a university in our town, so it's a university town. A lot of my family worked at the University of Guelph, and as soon as I could, I left Guelph because they were going to try and get me to go to the university. But, I grew up here in Guelph, spent a lot of time with my grandparents who are from Italy. They taught me everything I know about cooking and family. Spent a lot of time reading, and so, spoiler alert, I'm a bit of a nerd. My grandmother, who loves history, she's the one who really instilled in me a love for learning about the past, and really so much so that I dedicated now most of my life to studying history all the way from my undergrad to my master's up to a PhD. And yeah, so I did, I went to Rutgers and spent around 8 years living in the U.S., which had a profound impact on me, for sure, as a young girl from Canada.
Wow. I know I was trying to give our listening audience a kind of an understanding of what DEI is. Can you add on to that? And so our listening audience will know exactly what diversity, equity, inclusion really is.
Yeah, absolutely. So as Michelle mentioned, like, we hear a lot about DEI. It is a major buzzword. But we often don't sit to think about and break down what those letters mean, So when we talk about diversity, as you mentioned, James, we're talking about people's identities and the differences. So you mentioned race is one thing, ethnicity, disability, sexual orientation, gender identity and expression, your national origin, your socioeconomic status, the way you think and your communication styles. That's what we think about when we talk about diversity. It's what people bring about themselves to the workplace. When we think about equity, we're talking about ensuring fair treatment, equality of opportunity, and equality a quality for opportunity for success as well. And then when we're talking about inclusion, we're talking about how can we build a culture of belonging by actively inviting the contribution and participation of all people. So, you know, when we think about what DEI looks like in action, we often hear DEI initiatives or programs, and this usually applies to ensuring that our business practices embrace diverse employees, create equitable practices and policies so that we can actually have diverse people coming in the door. And then when we think about inclusion, what does our workplace look like so that people want to stay? How can they bring them whole? How can they bring their whole selves to work? The ultimate goal is that companies and organizations will start to just apply this lens to all their business practices, so that it doesn't just become an initiative or a program, but an actual way of doing business.
Wow. Dr. Horn, you are Canadian. What led you to do a PhD in Black history?
That's a great question. I got that a lot. What are you doing down here? How did you get to this place? So it's kind of a funny story, or a bit of a happy accident. So it all started in my first year of university. I was picking courses that summer, and I originally wanted to take a course on witchcraft. And actually, so did a bunch of other people that year. So that course was full. But the only other course that was open during that time was a course on the civil rights movement. And as a young woman who lived, you know, a relatively privileged life, learning about activists like John Lewis, Bob Moses, Diane Nash, James Lawson, and the many others I could name, you know, these people who were my age at the time were willing to give their lives for the access to rights that, you know, I took for granted in my daily life. So, you know, to say I was inspired and moved is a bit of an understatement, but it really was the course that led me to sort of switch my focus. For the rest of my undergrad, I took as many courses as I could on history, on Black history. I also did courses on the history of race and racism. I wanted to understand, like, how did we get to this point? And what that eventually led to.
Hey, Dr. Horn, hold that thought. We got to take a station break, but I want to come back right after the break and pick this up. Yeah, so we're going to take a station break, but we're going to come back and continue our discussion with Dr. Melissa Horn. It's Your Life. I'm James Cooley. Welcome back. It's Your Life. I'm James Cooley. And I tell you, wow, we got Dr. Melissa Horn, and we're talking about an advocate. She is an advocate for diversity, equity, and inclusion. And if you want to be part of the conversation, just great conversation, that's 1-888-344-1170. Again, that's 1-888-344-1170. Dr. Horn, I had to take the break. We had to pay the bills. But you was explaining.
Absolutely.
You was explaining what led you to pursue a PhD in Black history. Can you continue that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, you know, to sort of make what was happening to be a long story a bit shorter is that ultimately what I started to see when I was doing I was looking at the history of scientific racism, and I was down in the archives at Fisk and Spelman, and as I was digging through, sort of trying to understand what the early courses looked like at the schools, I started to see traces of student activism that looked a lot like the activism we typically associate with the student activists of the 1950s and 60s. So one of my professors back up here in Canada who had done her PhD at Rutgers said, if you're serious about doing this work, then you got to go to the U.S. And luckily, you know, I was accepted into the Rutgers History Program, which has one of the best Black history faculty in the country. And I was able to pursue that work and that research.
Wow. So you studied the early history of Black student activism at historically Black colleges and universities. Can you tell us about your research?
Yeah. So what I was really interested was looking at, you know, knowing that so many of the prominent activists and figures of the 50s and 60s came out of a number of HBCUs, I wanted to understand what was that culture. What was it about these schools and the culture that produced these student activists? So when I started doing the research, what I found was that really in the early, it all goes back to the earliest 20th century where this culture of protest was first created. And it started first on by students on their own campuses fighting for curricular reforms, racial and gender equality, to increase the representation of power of Black faculty and administrators. And, you know, these student activists during the early 20th century, they were also protesting the social, political, and economic injustices of life in Jim Crow America. So what I started to see was that many of these students were actually pioneering and using the same words and language, the nonviolent direct action strategies that would become the hallmark of the modern civil rights movement. And it really was their ideas, aspirations, and even organizations that laid the groundwork for really the generation of students who would follow.
What's the most surprising thing you learned about when you were doing your research?
So, you know, we often think about civil rights and protests as sort of the big, big moments. But the really interesting thing was that a lot of resistance and protest comes in everyday acts of resistance. So from the way that students chose to dress, you know, there was a really strict uniform. And the way that and students would add things that were, you know, like pieces of jewelry or color that wasn't, you know, wasn't allowed. And it sounds kind of silly, but at this point, you could be expelled, and if you were expelled from university, you weren't accepted anywhere else. So these students were sort of taking, you know, a stand in these very interesting and, you know, subtle ways to resist the system of oppression that was imposed upon them. And so I think the cool thing that I learned is that really it's about the little acts of resistance as well, and not just that can lead to the bigger ones. So that was kind of some of the interesting things. I mean, there's tons of historical facts that I learned, but it was a new way of thinking about what resistance looks like.
Hey, Dr. Melissa, producer Noah here. What led you to transition out of academia into the DEI space? Was there a catalyst that made you jump from one field to the other?
That's a great question. I love researching. I love digging through the archives. And I love the discipline of history, but it's not a collaborative field in the way that, you know, psychologists co-write papers or other fields, you know, work together. And while I was living in D.C., I was doing a lot of volunteer work. You know, when I was there, this was during the fight for marriage equality. And I realized that a lot of the stuff that I'd learned through my research was applicable, you know, to the issues and events of today. And so, you know, I gained a lot of knowledge through my research about how to put social justice work into action. And I wanted to work to help folks make their workplaces and lives more equitable. So it seemed a natural transition for me to be able to take what I'd learned and actually put it into practice in the day-to-day.
I also know that our listening audience may have an idea of what they think DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion is, but why don't you tell us, because I know there's probably some myths, what it is not.
Oh, man. So, let's go back. First, there's a lot of pressure right now on companies and organizations to respond to the acts and events that are happening. So, you know, last year we saw folks putting up a black square on social media in solidarity with Black Lives Matter movement. But if you get down into what's happening in the organizations, they're not actually putting it's performative. So what DEI isn't, it's not performative. It's not something that you can just put up a social media or change your logo to the pride flag, right? It's about actually doing the work. And so, you know, it's about how can you hold yourselves accountable. And not everyone's ready, and that's okay. And you don't have to be, you know, the most equitable, inclusive organization. But what you need to be is ready to start to make that change and start to set goals and milestones. It's okay to be in progress. It's interesting. I was having a conversation with another woman today, and we were talking about, you know, this work, it doesn't happen overnight, and it's not going to happen with just some social media posts. It's going to happen with small incremental systemic changes that shift the culture of the workplace. So, you know, while a lot of people want to jump in and respond right away, it's work that takes time and effort, and it's ongoing. That's the other thing too. It doesn't just happen. You know, it's not a one and done thing. You can't just take one course and be done with it. And I think that's what a lot of people don't realize, is that it's a lifelong journey. I mean, I'm in this space. I'm always learning. I have blind spots. We all have our own blind spots because of the way that we move through the world, right? And that's okay. It's recognizing those and trying to shift and see the world through other people's perspectives. So it is an ongoing thing. And I think that's really the key. It's not something that you can just check a box and you're done.
Wow. Hey, Dr. Horn, how does your research impact or inform the work that you're currently doing?
So I mentioned earlier that one of the ways that my research informs work that I do is to really focus on the everyday acts of resistance or activism that people can take to make a difference. You know, as I said, we think that change requires these big protests or rallies, but it really starts with individuals making a commitment every day to be anti-racist, to be, you know, to stand in solidarity with LGBTQ people, to stand in solidarity with Indigenous peoples. And I think, you know, there's ways that, so I think that's how I look at this work, is that, you know, at the end, we're looking at these small collective acts to make a bigger change. And so
2 minutes.
That's what I learned from the students that I studied, is that these small acts can lead to really big change.
And just like you said, that a person has to be open-minded and they have to be, want to be aware that some things have to change, and just having an awareness and an understanding of people just because you perceive them as different. That's not how it should be, especially in any workplace, because a lot of time we look at people from the outside. You just see the physical portion of them. You don't know anything about the person, and we want to make judgment, and we want to treat them differently. You know, and I tell you, I am have learned over the years that it's not on the outside. You know, if you can't just look at a person physically and try to determine what type of person that is. So I really appreciate that answer.
Dr. Horn, can you tell us a little bit about Learning Snippets and its parent company, Dialectic?
Yeah, absolutely. So Dialectic's been around for about 10 years now. And what we do is we create inclusive, science-based learning experiences for workplaces. So our work is really guided by our commitment to using the insights and methods of science. So we're a bunch of, we've got philosophers, social psychologists on our team, and we really go and dig deep into the empirical work, but we also then kind of zoom out and create learning experiences that honors the voices and experiences of employees. So what our goal is really is to create measurable organizational change for our clients. So, you know, we have a lot of clients who come to us and looking to make a difference within their organization, and we design custom learning experiences for them. Learning Snippets is a micro-learning platform for building inclusive behaviors. So what we've done is we know that a lot of folks hear these words, as you mentioned, diversity, inclusion, unconscious bias, implicit bias, microaggressions. But what they lack is the way to practice inclusive behaviors. A lot of us want to be more inclusive, but we just don't have the practice, you know? And part of changing our behaviors is to get reps in, right? When we want to build a muscle, when we want to get better at something, it requires us to practice it. And so what we've done is we've created programs that are short, we call them snippets, short micro-learning lessons that you can do once a week to help you practice inclusive behaviors. And the goal is to make, you know, inclusive behaviors become an everyday thing. We work with a variety of subject matter experts to validate our content. We work with folks with lived experience and those who are subject matter experts, and we fuse the insights from industry leaders with our scientifically proven approach to training that creates a new way of diversity, equity, inclusion training that actually starts to change people's behaviors.
Dr. Horn, can you tell us about some of the impact that you're seeing from your e-learning programs?
Yeah, that's probably one of the favorite parts of my job is talking to people, about how the training is starting to impact them. And what we're seeing is folks are saying to me that, we're having conversations that we were scared to have before. And being able to have conversations that are uncomfortable are really important for organizations to start to change. Being able to, people are saying that they're reflecting on their own biases and they're starting to reckon with some of the beliefs that they've held, they're realizing that some of the jokes or ways that they were talking to coworkers were inappropriate, and they're catching themselves before they make these statements. People are saying that, that they're more open to the feedback that they hear when people are calling them out, and that's what we're looking for. We're looking for these small incremental changes in behaviors that make our workplaces more inclusive, that starts to shift our culture so that we can make start to improve the policies and practices that impact people's lives.
Wow. Can you tell us about your podcast called Just One Q? I'm dying to hear about that.
Oh, man. Well, I feel bad for my guests because we set the challenge that can we make a short and impactful podcast that really focuses on one question and leaves our listeners with tangible takeaways. So my goal is to, I speak with all sorts of industry experts around issues of diversity, equity, and inclusion in the workplace. I ask them just one question. It's usually a really big question. The goal is to really elevate the voices and thought leaders in this space. And so for me, I invite guests on from all over Canada and the U.S. who have different perspectives, and you can give our audience things that they can start to implement in their lives and in their workplace right away. They're short, 15 minutes, but the guests are great, and it leaves you with a lot to think about.
Dr. Melissa, producer Noah, again, and I love podcasting. I have my own outside of radio, and I listen to several. I love the field. It's similar to radio, but different. How do you choose your guests? Obviously, you use industry experts, but how do you decide which guests and which experts you invite onto the show?
Oh, wow, that's a great question. So, often we're following current events, but for me, it's really important to elevate voices who may not traditionally get heard. So it's important to me to invite folks on. So we've had folks talking about neurodiversity and neurodiverse individuals on the show. Definitely elevating the voices of Black, Indigenous, people of color. That's really important to me. I always look for folks who have a unique perspective and that are going to challenge me and others to really rethink how they're thinking about diversity, equity, and inclusion. So I'm looking for people who are progressive, who are disruptors, who are really making change in their personal lives and professional lives.
Dr. Horn, besides being the right thing to do, research indicates that DEI directly impacts the revenue and success of a company. Can you explain how this is so?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's, a lot of, it is the right thing to do for sure. But the reality is that having a more diverse workforce leads to bottom line in your revenue. For example, more diverse workforces, there's stats out there, I can't think of them right now, but basically increase the bottom line of an organization. The other thing is that recently, I don't know if you guys remember the Basecamp, where the CEO and founder of Basecamp said that he's not going to allow any political speech at work and saw 60% of his workforce leave. So right there, we're in an employee market right now, and folks have the power and they want to choose workplaces that align with their values. So they're looking for workplaces, if they're young parents or if they're people who have caring responsibilities for elder relatives, they want a workforce that's going to be flexible. They're looking for workplaces that, you know, align with their... with
4 minutes.
And what we're seeing is that companies that aren't catching up and focusing on DEI are seeing higher turnover. They're losing employees. The consumers are boycotting or they will put their money elsewhere, right? So it directly affects your bottom line. The other thing to do is that, you know, when we reinvest and when we invest in other companies and are thinking about who we're going into business with, that also, you know, brings us referrals from other diverse populations that we may not have considered as well. So there's a ton of different reasons why, you know, thinking strategically about
3 minutes
inclusion and how your company operates can impact your bottom line.
Wow. You know, Dr. Hone, what are your thoughts on companies making diversity training mandatory?
Yeah, so personally, I think it's the right move. You know, every employee deserves to feel safe and respected at work. And so, you know, we used to see diversity, equity, inclusion as something that was training that was nice to have. But it needs to be normalized as part of our lives. You know, injustice can't be the status quo. The organizations, if they really want to hold themselves accountable and not just pay lip service to DEI issues, but actually make it part and parcel with the organizational culture, needs to start making this training mandatory. And I think the other thing is that employees who want to work with that organization need to start abiding by that by those policies. So in the same way that we make a bunch of different
2 minutes
mandatory, we need to include this as part of our culture, right? And that's what I think I mentioned earlier, is that we're not just sort of having initiatives or programs, but in really embedding diversity, equity, inclusion into the culture. And it starts with training and making that mandatory. And that shows that your company takes this seriously and is going to start to hold people accountable to upholding those values.
But have, you know, in your research, have you presented this to some companies that they might need to think about this? And what type of response did you get back?
I think a lot of... organizations, you know, given last year, we're in a moment here, we're in a historical moment, and companies know that they need to act. So given the event of last year with the murder of George Floyd, folks are really taking a hard look at what their companies are doing. And I think the thing is that employees are holding
1 minute
their leaders accountable. So, you know, they're giving feedback and they're making moves if employers aren't following through with this. So they can't. So they want the training. They want organizations to offer this. And I think leaders, where I see resistance is just not knowing where to start. And I think that's the resistance we see, is that people think this is a big thing that they have to solve right away. And what we're working with them to say is that this is something that needs to happen incrementally over time.
Wow. Hey, Dr. Hone, so what does social justice look like in the workplace today, and how can leaders create a safe space for diverse voices and cultural intelligence?
Yeah, so I think, you know, it would look like a workplace where everyone is accepted and supported regardless of where they're from, you know, the color of their skin, their orientation. You know, we may be different, but first and foremost, we're humans. And I think leaders can start to create a safe place through their own learning journey. You know, I think it starts with leaders and accepting that, you know, that they have blind spots and really being ready to start the, you know, we often refer it to the learning and unlearning process. And that means sort of unlearning some of the stereotypes and learning about where they might need support. I think it looks at how you're doing business. Are you applying a social justice lens to all your business practices? You know, are you going out and looking for candidates from the same pool? Are you going to the same school? You know, are you, is your pipeline filled with the same people? Because, you know, it starts with bringing in diverse voices, diverse people. Does your company, you know, on its website, attract the type of employees that you want? You know, can people see themselves in your company? And if not, then you got to start to look at why not. You know, from recruitment, performance management, training, do you have equitable systems, policies, and practices in place that not only ensure representation within your company, but representation in places that hold power? So it's not enough just to say, you know, our workforce is diverse. And you look at the demographics, and it's mostly diverse folks at the front line. Do you have diverse voices and representation at the top where decisions are being made? You know, you want to think about who's making decisions. As I mentioned, you know, where are we finding talent? Are we actively recruiting and cultivating diverse pipelines? Have we done an audit of our job descriptions? Are there unnecessary education components that automatically exclude or create barriers for certain candidates? You know, I see all sorts of job descriptions out there for entry-level jobs, and they're asking folks for years and years of work experience. But we discount a lot of life experience. You know, you don't need, you know, a master's for an entry-level job, and you're, you know, and is your language inclusive? We often find that, you know, people use certain language that attract sort of male candidates. What's kind of the buzzword these days? A lot of like tech companies will put, you know, coding ninjas, which sort of signals, you know, that men should apply and not women, you know. And once we have diverse candidates in the door, what does the pipeline for advancement look like? We need to look at how we promote people into leadership roles. You know, what metrics are we using for this? Are these decisions being made on the golf courses or based on an equitable process that is meant to reduce biased decision-making, right? Employee resource groups are a great way to boost inclusion and belonging and to support a strong employee experience strategy. The most successful ERGs are those that have support and budget. So that's the other thing, too. Are you putting money into investing, right? Because it's not enough just to say, well, you know, we're going to do these initiatives. You have to put money into it. And support programming that, you know, allows employees to use work hours for initiatives, provides channels for these groups to influence business decisions, right? So those are ways that organizations can really start to apply that social justice lens.
Dr. Melissa, what is it about this work you've talked about a lot this hour that keeps you going? Because it's obviously not an easy process or thing to talk about. It can get quite hard to make lasting change. So what is it that keeps you going at the end of the day?
You know, what I love about my job is the relationships that I have and the people that I meet. I work, you know, I meet often clients, and we have a large group of collaborators. And the folks in the DEI space are so generous. They're brilliant. I'm constantly learning from them, and you know that's what makes this work amazing. You know, is that there's so much to learn, and as someone who loves learning, this is a field where there's so much change happening, and there's so much going on that, you know, it's an exciting field to be in. The other thing is hearing the stories from individuals of how our training is impacting them and their workplaces, how it's making them reevaluate their own biases, hearing the changes that they're making in their own lives, not just at work, but we're hearing about how folks, you know, are using the training to connect with their kids or their family members. And it's those small things that really keep me going, knowing that we're making a difference for folks.
Wow. Doctor, we've been talking about leadership in the organization, but what can the employees of the organization, what can they do to help advocate and also be in compliance with understanding what this means, diversity, equity, and inclusion?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question. So absolutely, you know, I think leaders have a role to play in ensuring that there's funding for training and programs. But, you know, as an employee, you can also start to speak up. We're seeing a lot of folks sort of from the ground up pushing to make changes in their organizations, right? You know, one of the things you can do, it's called being an active bystander. It means calling out microaggressions when you hear or see them. If someone tells a joke that you know isn't okay, you need to say something, right? You know, it's not always easy or comfortable, but speaking up in that moment means that you're showing solidarity. You know, often our silence says a lot. You know, this goes back to the idea that protests and major policies aren't the only ways to make change happen. Just thinking about in our daily lives, we all have our own spheres of influence, right? You can make choices in your life that can have an impact, from, you know, where you buy your coffee to where you buy your groceries. Choosing to support BIPOC-owned businesses or LGBTQ-owned businesses, you know, investing in these companies that can in turn reinvest in their own communities. You can think about where you spend your money and how you donate your time and services as well, right? You know, corporate social responsibility is a huge thing. If there's an initiative in your community, or if you know of an organization that needs support, you know, have your company donate time and resources to supporting those initiatives. So there's ways that we can make change happen, you know, not just in the workplace, but in our own lives.
Wow. And Dr. Holmes, so if a company is just starting, and say, we got the leader, CEO, listening to this conversation, what would you recommend a starting point? You just mentioned initiatives, so training, culture, et cetera. What would you say this is what you might want to start at first?
I would think about why you want to do this work. I would take a long, hard look. You know, there's so much happening, and it's our knee-jerk reaction to want to do something. I'm advocating for people to just stop and pause for a second and to realize that this is work that, you know, isn't easy, that will be uncomfortable, and that will take time. And to really, you know, it's not about shame or blame, because we all, as I mentioned, we all have our own blind spots. But this is work that is hard and takes time. So I would say take that time to sort of really think, are you ready to do this? Because it will take investment, resources as well, and making sure that you're ready to allocate that time. The next thing I would say is don't try to do it all on your own. There are amazing diversity, equity, and inclusion consultants out there who do this, who can help your organization to succeed.
90 seconds.
Thing, you know, taking that time to pause and really thinking through how you're going to go about this, because right now, you know, everyone's fear is being seen as performative. And I think, you know, sort of jumping into this without really thinking it through could do a lot more harm than being honest with your employees, with your staff, and saying, you know what, I'm not exactly sure where to start. We need some help as an organization, and it's going to take some time. But that honesty and being, you know, aware of where you are says so much more than just, you know, throwing a bunch of initiatives out there that don't go anywhere, that never make any change.
Employees
would rather see things happen over time than stuff that doesn't go anywhere.
Wow. Hey, Dr. Holmes, we're down to the last minute. How can our listening audience, anybody listening to this real quickly, how could they get in touch with you if they wanted to follow up a little bit more with this?
So you can connect with me on LinkedIn. You can reach me by email. It's melissa.horn@dialectic.solutions. You can check out the Just One Cue podcast on your favorite platform, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google. I'm sure they could probably reach me through your show as well, but I'm always happy to connect with folks.
Wow. Hey, I really appreciate you taking the time to come on the show. And yes, all of your social media platforms is listed on all of my social media platforms so they can reach out. So, Dr. Horn, thank you so much. I'd like to thank my co-host, Michelle, who's always here. I'd like to thank my great producer, Noah. Most importantly, I'd like to thank our listening audience for taking time to tune in every night to It's Your Life. We'll be back tomorrow at the same time, same place. It's Your Life. I'm James Cooley.